to the Mug Meetings Summaries Podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our March meeting's main topic was distributed operating systems, presented by Rob Kaiser.
And in case you've forgotten from an hour and a bit ago, we have Robert Kaiser talking about the unpronounceable something at the bottom.
Yeah.
Distributed operating systems.
That matter. Anybody want to take a stab at what you pronounce that is? I honestly don't know.
Carrot.
Should there be a red squiggly line under anything?
I'm just calling it curd for purposes of for this presentation.
It's Klingon.
Yeah.
It's actually Klingon or Gaelic, which are second cousins.
Yeah. That one comes from the French company that's Kurg Labs, so I'm assuming it's some kind of an anagram. But
German.
No clue.
Anyways. Carried. Carried.
Yeah.
It's a big stick that figure skaters carry to break out of the
Right.
Moving right along.
So, I'm Robert Kaiser. I sit on the board here at Mug. I currently work at ThinkVox. Prior, I worked at Less.net and Prime Focus. I'm a systems administrator. And, yeah, that's me. So, we're going to go over a very basic overview of what a distributed operating system is compared to a grid or some kind of other cluster system. Some really old operating systems that nobody ever uses anymore, ever. PMS. No, this is before the 80s. Well, yeah. Anyways, then we're going to get into the Linux side, just is what I'm most familiar with. So the three at the OpenMosix, OpenSSI, and Kurd. are all Linux modifications.
Which one?
That one. Oh, hey, look at that. It's even brighter. All right, so there's a little preview of what kind of crap I can make work. So that effectively is going to turn into a cluster, and I've got a demo with a lot of hardware actually working.
What the heck kind of power supply is that?
What? The... Okay, just one of that one?
The triple.
Yeah, triple redundant. It's actually a modification of the ones that are here.
Cool.
Anyways, so distributed operating system versus grid. As you can see, the grid system is over top of the user space. That usually is the form of, say, DISCC is my favorite example, because it simply is over top. It uses SSH, it uses whatever kind of file system you're using. It's over top. You can also get some that are like Xgrid by Sun, or I guess Oracle now, or I don't even know what they are anymore. think higher level abstraction of network. These are basically distributed operating systems. The main difference is that you don't have anything up there. The operating system itself does the distribution.
I don't know if that's a word.
Distribution. That one. Thank you. One of the upsides. Next slide is
pros and cons.
Yeah, so problems with the grid. You have to use the grid. It is the main problem. If you're using DISCC, you must set the CC flag to be DISCC. If you're using, say, a company I work for has a product called Deadline, which is effectively massively sending in a file, and then it goes and it renders things on all kinds of machines. You have to use it if you want to render to all the machines. That can cause problems, but usually they're pretty intuitive. Another thing to take into account, if you're running, say, 200 Windows boxes, you must update Windows on every box. That was an issue at Prime, not really, but somewhat. More to the point, it's just a pain in the ass. If you're running 10 different machines, it's 10 operating systems that you have to update. Depending on how you're doing that, it can be done easier, but it is a pain in the ass. The problems with distributed operating system is security, obviously. You are effectively creating a kernel that runs on bare metal that allows another piece over the network to have access to it all, which means if you are on that network, you could theoretically pose as a machine, connect to it, and wreak havoc without anybody knowing. So it must be VLAN'd off. I don't know of any actual implementations of network file systems that are in the Linux kernel that support SSL or encryption by default. I don't think there are. Theoretically, you could use Kerberos, but I wouldn't want to try, and I don't think, people are nodding, it's not possible, so.
No, it's not possible. It's not worth your sanity.
Yeah, exactly. So, security is a major issue with this, where the higher level distributed stuff, like grid computing, it runs over SSL, it runs over SSH, it's already there, you don't have to worry about it. If somebody comes in, they can't totally kill you. Distributed operating systems are considered more complicated to set up. You are creating a custom kernel from whatever source, and you are configuring it, which can be a real issue. So important notes. Each node, even if it's a distributed operating system, you can read. But basically, each node boots an OS. It must run on bare metal. You can't just magically have this happen. Some people I've talked to think that because it's a distributed operating system, it just works magically. You are running a kernel on each one of these machines, and it's at the kernel layer that it actually distributes it. So it's at the kernel layer that it goes, I'm over here, talk to me. This causes problems when you don't have device drivers. You must statically link network drivers of Linux kernel into that kernel. Otherwise, they cannot talk. This is before you actually get to loading modules. So there's one thing.
And that sounds like it's a lot more messy. It's heterogeneous, like you're, the set of you have.
Yes. So what it amounts to is you go through the make menu config, and you enable everything you can find and statically compile it in. And it takes a while. But at the same time, you know, it's going to work almost everywhere. So getting into the actual... Yeah, I told you. Getting into the actual distributed operating system started back basically as far as you can go in terms of the multi... No, relax! In terms of multi-user operating systems that are not VMS, that are not fourth, you get stuff like Amoeba. Amoeba, Andreas Tannenbaum worked on Amoeba. Earliest documentation I could find was in 86. Supposedly it was before then, but... I can't find anything to that effect. Anybody know what modern scripting language was actually developed for Amoeba? Shout it out if you know it.
Wasn't that LUA?
No, take a guess. Right.
Python?
Yes, Python was actually originally developed for Amoeba.
That was in 89.
Yeah. Anyone heard of Orca? It's another language that was developed specifically for this. It's used somewhat in mathematical stuff. Amoeba itself runs on all kinds of hardware. Including Motorola things, apparently. It runs on Sun hardware, x86 hardware, old stuff. And I honestly think that's Motorola, but somebody's going to smack me and say that's Intel, probably.
It is Motorola. Sun 3 series.
Okay, we're good. So, technically, the last three.
So, someone should still smack you.
Yes. Anyway, that is actually at Brigitte's. The university in the Netherlands, I can't pronounce it, where this was originally developed.
Pre-university?
Correct me, yell at me, I don't care, I can't pronounce it next day. That's a basic idea of what Amoeba looks like when it boots up. It's really nothing that special. I did try and run it myself. Problem with Amoeba is that it takes three computers at a minimum to get this thing working. It separates out groups of servers, groups of nodes, I should say. Which means that you have a file server, you have a computational server, and you have a terminal server. You can add more to each one of them, but you cannot run a cluster without three. It also makes problems because, as you can imagine, you run different software on each one, different services on each one. The kernel might be the same, but likely it's slightly different. It's got different flags, that kind of stuff. So you're effectively creating a heterogeneous kernel that has to talk to each other at the kernel layer. It becomes very complicated. I managed to get it installed, and they talked to each other, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. It's pain in the ass.
That makes sense for the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. That's the main thing, is for the time period, it makes sense because you did not have huge disk arrays or tape arrays or any other kind of storage on terminal servers. You had to separate it out. It makes sense. Plan 9 does a similar instance where it separates it out. You can separate it out, I should say. Plan 9 itself is in the 80s. Well, 92 is when it was released to universities, 95 to the general public. Basically, all devices are part of the file system. This is a major, major thing. This is where proc started. This is where dev started. Well, maybe not dev, no, but proc for sure. And this was taken to an extreme in that there was actually a /net/, and you could type in an address, and it would give you the contents of that HTTP address. So you could technically go cat /net/http:// google.ca, and it would give you the raw text of whatever got pulled down. Yeah. Made it very nice to script on, I would imagine.
They actually stole that from Apollo Domain OS.
Really?
Which was an even earlier distributed OS.
There you go. See, I haven't heard of that. So I'm bound by,
they don't exist anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Plan 9 runs on all kinds of stuff. X86, MIPS, Stack Alpha. Spark. And ARM, surprisingly. People have actually been keeping it up to date, or at least being able to boot. I don't know about functionality, but it runs on PowerPC and ARM, apparently. It's also where Union Directories came up. So UnionFS, you might have run into it if you ever used Slacks, the operating system. It used something similar to it. It started branching off and using SquashFS and other things. But effectively, it allows you to say, basically create a snapshot. Use this is my file system here. It has a.out, for example. And I tell it, this is another file system over here. And its base is that. So if you do an ls, you'll see a.out. You remove a.out, it removes it on this side, does not remove it on that side. So it allows you to actually have some kind of a snapshot model based like that. Yeah, so proc was first implemented here because processes were, well, you need to have a way to access them on the file system.
Of course.
So you get slash proc, and everybody knows what that is, give or take. There's a Plan 9 screenshot that I pulled off the net. It's one of the major ones out there. The window manager is crazy to work with. It is not nice to work with. You need to know what you're doing. It does have a mail client, as you can see over there. It shows you what's running, and you can see the servers up here that shows you the load. CPU usage and stuff. It's really not nice to work with, though. One thing, though, it is Bell Labs. So it was developed by Bell Labs. It's still hosted by Bell. I don't know where, but it's hosted somewhere.
California.
Yeah. I came across one that said that Plan 9 was distinct groups. I realize that it's not, after doing a little bit more research. But you can separate it out. And it's, again, from an era where you might want to. Even in the 90s, you don't want to have terminal servers having disk. So you can separate it out. It's not required. But anyways, from what I could find, and actually running it myself, I did separate it out. So the next couple slides might say that it does. But bear with, keep in mind that it can. It's not a requirement for the Plan 9. It uses the 9P protocol, which basically means, yeah, it's used for everything. Absolutely everything. Any inter-process communications between nodes, any kind of thing going between nodes, it is used. It becomes really complicated because, well, like I said, it's used for file systems, printers. You want to do an IPC call to that computational node over there. That's what's used. It's complicated. And Ken Thompson was one of the authors of 9P and part of Plan 9. So nice little bit of a thing. And, again, there's the only other discrepancy. Both Plan 9 and Amoeba, scratch that. Amoeba and possibly Plan 9, depending on how you configure it, can be set up this way. Starting with OpenMosix, push to make them identical, meaning that it's one kernel that you use. Yes, it's loaded onto 20 machines, or X number of machines, nodes, but it is the same kernel. This makes it so that you can actually say, include all device drivers, and it will work in a heterogeneous system. Also means that, well, a lot of complexity is taken out because you don't have to worry about, my God, the image for the file server died, but I still have computational nodes. Yeah. So, OpenMosix, starting there. It is a single system image. So, what that means is, well, it has a single root, effectively. It's NFS mounted, mostly. It does actually do automatic load leveling. So processes, not threads. You have a process, you fork it, it can migrate, and it can actually do automatic load leveling. The problem becomes when you have a process that threads. Not so much. You can migrate the whole process tree, including the threads, but you may not migrate threads individually. It is a 2.4 branch modification. Moshibar discontinued it in March of 2008, I believe. He announced it a year... Hey, look at that. He announced it a year earlier, basically saying because of SMP systems, the fact that you can have a laptop that has 8 cores on it means that this is useless. Or at least that's what I deal with. That's he lost development time and interest. He stopped working it. It is 2.4, which means that you can actually run it with Ubuntu 6.06. I know people who do. I know of people who actually use it as an LTSP server for a hospital. Because they have a back end of, say, like, I don't even know how many machines. And you just have all the machines in the hospital connect to this and run LTSP. Since it's Linux, it works. It's Ubuntu. It's somewhat supported. Not that far back. It's 2.4. But it works. Linux PMI actually took over that. And they basically took all the 2.4 code and tried to make it into 2.6 code. I can't find anybody that's gotten that to work. Apparently it does. I tried to compile it. It breaks miserably. But people claim it works. I don't know if it does or not. There are other things that do it better than Linux PMI. The Linux PMI was the first push to actually take exactly OpenMosix and put it to the 2.6 branch of the Linux kernel, which is the limiting factor for OpenMosix. OpenMosix could have gone on ages and ages and ages because it's simply a kernel modification. This is all OpenMosix is. So, in essence, OpenMosix and OpenSSI, well, less so OpenSSI, but OpenMosix specifically is simply a set of kernel patches. You can actually get the diffs and look through the code yourself. One thing that's nice about OpenMosix, it has a live CD, and it has auto-configuration. And when I say auto-configuration, I mean true auto-configuration. You plug in with the laptops we have here, plug in a live CD, it will start up, and it will add nodes, and poof, it works. You will see those processes on all of them.
That's cool.
It does some black magic. I'm not sure how it resolves crap, but it works. There's a screenshot of John Ripper writing on an OpenMosix server. You can kind of see how this works. Basically, your compute nodes, or in this case, nodes, period, can do whatever. And so you're presented with this higher level abstraction. So say you have the three laptops right here. They're all x86. Some of them might be 64, but they're all at least x86. These things you see individually. With OpenMosix, you would see a higher level SMP system. You would actually see the total number of CPUs on this. You would see the total number amount of RAM on this. It shares it, and so it allows you to program, and it allows anything you run on the top of the operating system to actually use all of it underlying. This is the main facet of distributed operating systems versus grid computing. So the usefulness is, say you're running this crazy Java thing that dies and runs out of memory and uses tons of CPUs. You can actually do it, and you don't need to configure your code at all because the operating system takes care of it. It is done at a lower level of load level versus running, you know, MPI or something like that, which is, I'll get into later. But
you're saying that an application can actually spread across?
Yeah, that's the thing, is assuming...
How does that work? You drop which is made?
Well, you're saying, like, you've got two kernels, for example, two Linux kernels that are identical. They talk to each other over the network. They figure out, hey, I'm over here, I'm over there. As long as you tell the kernel that, hey, when I do a check to see if what's running, it checks that side too, you can actually keep it across. And you can do shared memory. You can do some really crazy stuff. It does not interrupt, which means that you can actually migrate processes around your farm without an issue. IPC calls itself are actually across the network. What that means is you've got something like John running. It's not doing a heck of a lot of inter-process communication. Something like...
Linpack. Linpack.
Yes, that's a good example. Something like Linpack does a hell of a lot. So it will be heavily, heavily dependent on IO-bound traffic because not so much the bandwidth used, but the latency. You're talking about on a dual-core system or even on a, you know, dual-socketed system, you're going from a board to a board or a CPU inside it, like, to another part of the CPU. What happens when you're going out the network card, over the Cat5 cable, into another one? Or better yet, through a switch, which is exactly what's running. You have a huge, huge latency. Well, okay, you have sub-millisecond latency, but that is massive when you're talking each individual IPC. Because, let's face it, a program that's running, it's not actually, when you program, say, something in C, you don't care about how many IPC calls it. It's assumed that it will work flawlessly and quickly, which makes it a problem. So you have to account for that in your design. John works well. Building would work well.
Shared memory, not so great.
Shared memory works, but it's not so great because then your memory is going over the network as well.
What is John?
John the Ripper is a password cracking utility. Effectively, it can do basically any hash known to man. And there's also MPI patches available for it, although it's not in mainline John yet.
The reason that's a good one is because it's embarrassingly parallel.
Yes.
If you're brute forcing a password, there's the space you're searching, right? You just carve up the space, and you don't have to join up again until you've searched your entire subspace. And so you don't even need inter-process communication or shared memory or something.
Yeah.
If your program's using fork, and it calls itself with fork, with like new arguments, it doesn't have to be using fork. It can be doing a full new execution, you know, calling a shell and the shell calling the other program. Then you have separate programs, and there's not the only relationship. You know, an argument was passed, and You should continue.
Yeah, no, I'm just grabbing my coffee cup.
But effectively, that's the main thing with OpenNosix is...
You've got to be embarrassingly parallel.
Yeah. With any distributed operating system, your program must be able to be run in parallel. If you run forks, it will work, you will hit an overhead, and it will be noticeable. But at the same time, for a lot of things, you don't care. So OpenNosix has the MFS file system. Moving on. This is kind of crazy. MFS here is the slash file system on that node. So if you're logged in to, say, node 2, that is slash on node 2, whereas MFS home would be slash on the boot node, which is usually node 1. It allows you to do crazy, you know, accessing of files across networks. And MFS selected is the selected node, which means you can actually go and select different nodes without an issue, and your program will, assuming you actually use MFS selected, or you can symlink it to wherever, it will use whatever you're selecting. Yeah, it's ugly. It's not pretty. It's an extra file system that is there to help you. It is not required to run programs. If you program scripts or an actual compiled program to make use of it, great. If you don't, it's not going to hurt. It uses added proc support, which means that basically slash proc contains extra crap. You can see it there. Mosix ID is what node you're on, so you can see the load, mem, and speed specific. It's not a remote mount of slash proc. But
begs the question, is slash MFS slash selected slash proc?
Yes, it would be.
Okay.
And the main thing is, you see all the processes. You do a PS, you do a top, everything that's running on every machine, you will see.
Under slash proc.
Yeah, exactly. You can actually migrate processes. You can force it to migrate using the migrate command, or you can lock it, which basically means stay where you are. This is a major thing if you're, you know, running it like I am in a heterogeneous environment with not the same processors, and you're heavily, heavily I.O. bound. You don't want your memory over there when your process is running over here. It's bad. Really, really bad. So you can do that, and it locks it. That's useful for a shell. Basically locks, you know, the self is the main thing. Perl and Python modules are available. Basically, they implement libmosix for C. There's headers. There's specific functions that allow functionality. Again, it's not required of programs to use this, but it is heavily advised because you can take a lot of performance hit if your program does not use it correctly. This is also used, like I said, LTSP. I came across one that was used for POV, right? But effectively, anything that is easily paralleled can work with this great. Compiling work well with this as well. Compiling a kernel, I should say, because of all the modules and the individual pieces. But LTSP works well because you have whole X session that starts off remotely. Another use connects, it's another whole process, as opposed to threads. That is the main thing. You thread something, it's not going to work the same in OpenNosix. Getting on to OpenSSI. Hold on, I'm kind of not feeling well. Last updated a year ago, it is slightly outdated. 2.6.12. Anybody know what operating system runs on that? Well, I guess.
I mean, distro.
Yeah. What distro runs on that, or at least came out at that point?
Red Hat.
Besides
6.06.
Pretty close. 6 and 7. And yeah, those will work on it. Those are not, you know, what's recommended.
Red Hat 9.
Yeah. Red Hat 9. FC 2. Fedora Core 2. Is stable on OpenSSI. That is what they recommend for a rock-solid, stable distribution. So, like I said, runs on 2.6.12. Old. Yeah. You should think old. You can make it run with new operating systems, but you keep in mind you're running an outdated kernel that probably has security patches and probably has huge holes somewhere. One thing is, single process space, meaning you do a PS, you see everything. You do a top, you see everything. You can kill processes. You can, well, in this case, migrate them. You could set the nice value to them. You could limit their I.O. You could do whatever you want. As normal Linux file system can, normal slash proc, you can do with OpenSSI to the whole farm, to the whole grid. One thing about global PIDs, they basically, to do this, PIDs normally have a limit of, I think, 65,000 or so, right? Something like that?
Yeah.
They actually prefix that so that you end up with a six-digit long PID. So it does make it kind of weird to use if you're not used to it. All it does is prefix it with usually a unique identifier of the machine that it was started on, but not always.
Yeah, like I said, I came across stuff that says it does, and then I ran it at my house and it doesn't. So, it is a single root. You NFS mount standard. You standardly NFS mount the whole server, the remote nodes, to the boot node. So, you create a directory, it's there, which is nice. Again, no specific programming is required, just like OpenMosix. You fork, you rexec. Well, effectively, you can use those, rfork and rexec, in the C commands, or you can actually use fork. You can set it to fork, and it will fork remotely. It is kind of crazy that way. 64-bit architecture is supported for the newer ones, and it is a requirement. And x86 itself is for the lower ones, because they ran into an address space issue, and so they forced it up to 64-bit. Like I said, crazy operating systems. And nice thing is, you have access to remote/dev. That means that if you're running, say, really high-end workstations, and you're doing this, you can actually access the graphics cards on each node. That means you could run CUDA. You could run any kind of crazy system you want to from one machine. This would give you the power of 200, 300, easily, graphics cards on one big server, making it very attractive. Keep in mind, this is all commodity hardware. This is all, you know, I should have brought my little LTSP thing, but it's Mini ITX. You can run it. I've run it with Mini ITX. It runs on anything. This is how bad it is out of date. You can't really read that. There's the one post that actually is not, you know, spam. Yay, baskets for free. Okay, there's some Spanish. I can't read it. Spring collection and hoodies are dropping in a week 6. Not even correct English. Their forums are overrun. That was March 7th. The timeline's also out of date. They haven't updated it. They do not have much work going on. That is a testament to their stable release is FC2. That's 1.2 is the version number. 1.9 goes up to, well, it's x86-64. It is specifically 64. And I have not found it working with CentOS 5 yet. Keep in mind that people that I know that have run OpenSSI in the stable branch, it is outdated operating systems, like outdated packages, because you're running FC2, for example. It is rock solid, though. Assuming you don't break anything, it will run, it will run. Local view is a command that's really nice. You prefix it like nice. So if you want to do a compile, you just nice, make, whatever. Local view restricts it to that node. It does not see the rest of the cluster. It does not see the processes, like it restricts IPCs, it does not see processes, devices, anything. Which makes it really nice to do, say, local view top. What is running on this individual node? It tells you which node is getting hammered. And if a node is getting hammered, you might want to migrate a process somewhere else if they have better CPUs. Low level, again, it's turned off by default, you can run it. And this is exactly, quite literally exactly what OpenMosix algorithms are. It's basically load levels across. It detects, hey, you've got a CPU spike on that machine, that process, and it's getting hammered because it's trying to go between three processes that are using 100% of CPU. We'll move a couple over. It is turned off by default, but it is one command you can run and it works. The nice thing is, you can turn it on globally or on individual nodes. This is almost a sub-cluster in a way, a subsystem. You can say, these three over here can load level between them, but the rest of the cluster can just use it normally. So it's a way of designating some or all of them to load level. It does have extensive guides and tutorials. It is very heavily documented. You can read up on it. It's great. It has lots of documentation, installs. Like I said, updated operating systems kind of arcane to get working, but if you like that sort of thing, it is rock solid state. One thing that I found, I didn't find it anywhere else, but I was searching around their website, and in /contrib, which is just simply random stuff that somebody decided to throw out there, contains Xen kernels. So, you could run a distributed operating system and run Xen, which effectively means you could run, say, a gazillion, okay, maybe not a gazillion, you could run 500 quite easily, 500 virtual machines, and you could manage it with one machine. This is an SMP system, and it gives you an overview of an SMP system. So you can SSH into it, and poof, you've got 20 CPUs, you've got 40 gigs of RAM, and you are running 10 virtual machines, for example, with Xen. You can do this with any other distributed operating system. Difference is this is a kernel implementation. This is para-virtualization, as opposed to full virtualization like QEMU. And I have not found another distributed operating system that has kernels built that have KVM, effectively, is what that is. But that's specifically for Zen, because it's an ancient thing. Obviously,
did you say Zen is ancient?
Well, no. I'm saying that the kernel that it's running on is ancient.
Oh, yeah. But I'm just trying to figure out how is Zen getting used to? Like you have your 30 or 100 computers. Is it that you can use Zen to sort of like okay, the way you conventionally use Zen is that you take one machine and you virtualize it into multiple machines. So what's that relationship when you're combining Zen and OpenSSI? Are you using what I'm guessing here is that you're using your constructed machine that OpenSSI creates for you, and then you're breaking it back down again using Zen?
Yeah, except the difference is that it's not specific to nodes, so you do have some failover if you wanted to do crazy stuff. OpenSSI has root failover, and if you use cluster virtual IP, you can actually do TCP sessions, do not die, which is kind of nice. Effectively, what that means is hosting companies could use this. You could, administration-wise, you would have one machine that has a huge amount of RAM, huge amount of CPU, and you would see all the VMs that all your clients are running.
Right. What you've done here is first you're putting everything together in one machine, and then you're recarving it up again with Zen.
Except the difference is that you can load balance between all of them. Meaning if two of your clients are spiking in the conventional system, they're running on one machine, they're fighting over resources. This allows you to migrate that open.
Okay.
Transparently.
Yeah.
So you can change your carve lines.
Yes.
Right? That is the difference. Build up a big fake machine by using
OpenSSI or
by using that technology, and then you decide how you carve it back up again into virtual machines.
But the difference is...
No, the big deal from a hosting company would be that you never have to manually load balance anything ever again.
Yeah. My God, two people are running on 8 cores and using all of them. Yeah. It just migrates. It load balance.
I guess if one machine goes down, you just drop it out.
Yeah, OpenSSI has support for actually adding machines in runtime, and removing nodes fails miserably because you can never be sure what the hell is going on, is the idea. Put it this way, anything that's running on the machine that dies will fail, guaranteed, because there is no failover of actual processes. So you don't have two processes running concurrently, and the IPC calls go to both. So it will fail. But that being said, if you're running, LTSP, and you're running one client on that machine that dies, that will go away. Your cluster will remain. The client will reconnect, and it will work.
But then if you recarve things with Zen, you have a single point of failure.
No, maybe that's
virtual machine.
No,
you have a single point of failure for a virtual machine.
Yes, that is
but
the difference.
The virtual machine can span several of these physical machines.
Yes.
Joined together in SSI.
Yeah, you can make
and
a
then if one of those machines fails.
Yep. That process is running on all of them. Goes completely. So it does have its.
Is there a problem with the hardware when you power virtualize the guest? So that means Zen is handling calls to the hardware.
Yep.
And so if you have the hardware running on, if you have a hardware attached to a bunch of different machines, does OpenSSI sort all that out and then Zen calls OpenSSI to get the hardware access?
That patch, I believe, is simply Zen and OpenSSI, meaning that you could. That's in slash trip. I didn't actually run it, but effectively you would have Zen calling the underlying system, which is actually in the kernel itself, yes. But even the lower level of the kernel would actually be OpenSSI managing the resource. So Zen would actually see that. There is a very, very small little bit that runs, that allows you for direct access to the CPUs and RAM, which is what parallel virtualization is. For the most part, you just want to run QEMU. I'll get to why later. You can do checkpointing with some distributed operating systems, meaning that, oh my god, it died. We'll set it up over there. Take a look. Main thing is, OpenSSI does allow for failover. Not great, but it works. Now we're on to Curg. Curg is, well, my favorite, mainly because I can't pronounce it. It's also the easiest to set up. It is really quite nice. It's a 2.6 branch, 2630. It means it runs decent, up-to-date operating systems without a hitch. I'm running 8.04 Ubuntu. It also supports Debian, Lenny, and Red Hat, well, I guess CentOS 5. So it's actually somewhat up to date. x86 and x86-64 architecture, this is split. x86 is for the lower one, like, because they hit an address space issue, they decided to fork the code effectively, anything below a certain revision, you have to run x86. Anything above, you have to run 64-bit. It will not compile. I tried to look at the code and see what exactly the limitation was. It is an address space issue. You cannot do it with the newer version because of how it's addressed. It is a single system image, meaning you do PS. It is global. Yeah, it's single process space. Also means slash is also across all of them, which is kind of nice, actually. Question?
How does carrots, or whatever it is, distribute the root file system?
NFS. You basically, how I do it, and how most people do it, is you set it up, and you netboot the nodes.
So you have an NFS server outside your SSI cluster.
You have a boot node that does everything. Mm-hmm. It has the files. It has the, like, yeah. Now, that is a single point of failure, which you can replicate to others. You can do dual nodes. Curve implements checkpoint and restart capabilities, which is really nice, actually. You have to prefix it with a command, but basically, if you're running a really crazy, long process that, you know, might die, you can checkpoint it. It keeps it, saving it all the time. You can stop it, just like you would with, I don't know, Control-Z, I guess would be the right one, and you can restart it later. Difference is, it saves its state across all machines. So you can, if you know you're going to have a huge maintenance, and you're running QMU, for example, as a client, as your hosting company, you can save every single state of all the machines to disk, take a couple of machines out, and then put it back. That's the new version of Kerg. Kerg supports, I have not tested it because I don't have x86 machines that work properly. Those, ignore it, but like the 64-bit, sorry. I don't have 64-bit x86 machines that work properly that I want to work with. But that is in the newer version of Kerg. The original version allowed for failover. It allowed nodes to randomly die and be added, and some processes would die horribly, but your system would remain intact. They took out that feature, and they're putting it back correctly, meaning that process dies, it doesn't actually matter because you've got it working. Nodes die, oh well. So that's not there yet with the x86, and they're not going to do it for x86. If you're running 32-bit, you're not going to have node failover. You're not going to have, right now, my system, if one computer that's running at my house were to die out of, I think, 5 that are running there, it would die. The cluster would go down. Each kernel would seg fault. It actually horribly, horribly dies because it depends on the other nodes to communicate. The whole cluster goes down if one fails. This is pretty bad from a hardware standpoint. So I wouldn't recommend 32-bit. 64-bit apparently has node failover. It did originally, but they took it out. 64-bit, they put it back, and they did it properly. I haven't tested it, but it's there. Distributed memory is with Kerg as well. So you can actually, again, you're I.O. bound. You do a huge process on this. You can actually logically address every single piece of memory in all the nodes, which allows you to do some really nice stuff. Problem is, you are I.O. bound. You're running memory that's supposed to be really, really fast and really, really nice through all kinds of network equipment, usually, and it causes problems. This, of course, can be mitigated if you want to run a fiber array or something like that.
InfiniBand.
Yeah. Like, yeah, if you want to run a mesh or if you want to run fiber switches as opposed to RJ45, latency is better. That's the only thing. Yes, very little bit, I know, but
it's FireWire.
Yes, except then I'd have to compile the kernel to support the damn thing.
Yeah. Well, it supports RDMA, so latency wouldn't be as much of a...
So, again, here's the thing. Here's an example. This is what I set up in December, I think. Can't really see it. Basically, it says uname-a gives you the kernel. It's running 2620, which is the SMP. It is the 32-bit version that's available. 2630 is actually the 64-bit only. It is running 804, so it is a somewhat up-to-date operating system. And to give you some idea of what it does, you do grep model name and your proc CPU. Anybody tell me what's weird about that? At that point, I have 1, 2, 5. Five machines running. Yeah, exactly. This is running on the same machine. These are actually, those two are actually dual socketed. That's a dual socketed machine. But, like I said.
Anyways, why do you think it's weird? Not because it's heterogeneous, because it's two manufacturers.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Is you can run Intel, you can run VIA, you can run, oh god, any architecture you can think of that is x86 compatible, and you can see them all right here without any issues.
I see a big issue with
that. Apps that have hand-optimized assembly.
Yeah, they fail miserably. they just die.
What CPU?
What about vector extensions? Too?
Yeah, no, it's they have
AMD and Intel vector extensions.
You have huge pitfalls because you're abstracting hardware and you don't know exactly what's running on what.
So lowest common denominator.
That's the thing. Out of these, probably SSE would be the correct one because they've got an Apple on there. SSE2 maybe, depending on the model, but
you have MMX.
They'll have MMX, exactly. So that's the point, is you have to accommodate for the lowest common denominator on your architecture.
Yeah, you could compile with MCPU, but not MArch for that, I would say.
Yeah, I was thinking cases like transcode and VLC and...
Yeah, and anything that uses decent down to the bare metal stuff.
But if you're doing custom compile options for anything that does a lot of math, you can use all those extensions, and you can't fit. Or you want to avoid a lot.
Well,
of them.
The thing to remember is, this is a heterogeneous environment.
Yeah.
I was going to set it up at ThinkBox, but I ran out of time. They have, say, like 10 blades, each with quad cores. They're identical hardware.
Yeah.
Meaning, I can actually run whatever I want on it. It's identical hardware. It's great. But it is flexible enough to do crazy shit like this, where you can have a VIA board and an Intel board and 20 AMDs showing up on one computer. Which is kind of weird. If you
can you lock processes, programs, computers?
Yes, you can. You can. Which is what I showed briefly. Maybe not with Kerg, but with OpenSSI, I showed that you can do it with Kerg. Especially, you actually have to allow it to remote migrate and allow it to distant fork. It is a flag that you must set using a special command. Actually, it's a binary that basically talks to the kernel. So by default, it does not.
So by default, the distributed operating system isn't very distributed.
Well, no. In some ways it is, some ways it isn't. You can logically address memory. You can logically address CPUs. There is what that machine was running. Like I said, that's just an example. this is from ages ago. But you can see NTPD is running twice, or more than twice probably. But that's the point, is it actually shows you every single process on every single node.
How do you tell the node indicator there?
There is no node indicator. Usually it's prefixed with an identifier for the node that it was started with. That I found to be false. So the way to do it is you can actually, not easily. How's that? You can force it to migrate. So you can say migrate this PID to this machine. If it's already there, it doesn't matter. But that's how you could see what it's running on. Horrible. But I haven't found an easier way.
So if a userland program opens a node in /dev on node A,
that's
migrate it to node B.
Kerg is actually doesn't allow for /dev to be global. Dev is local to that node.
So I better not ever migrate those Getty processes then.
No.
Okay. This explains why it's not the default.
Yes. Or DD, or something that requires a ton device for that matter. Any network card that is created, all that stuff. That's why OpenSSI does have a hand in some respects where you can logically address devices across the node. Kerg doesn't, which makes it great for computational, and that's about it, in all honesty. It's NFS, so it's a single file system, it's single process space, single RAM, shared RAM. Exactly. But the ones that do, all hell will break loose if you do decide to migrate it. It'll probably die miserably.
So, MythTV on Kerg, not in the near future.
No. Yeah. Like I said, 804, 2008 and up for Mandriva. I haven't run it. Debian Lenny supported. Those are the version numbers for what's supported in x86, 64, and x86. Those are just the current version numbers. Doesn't mean much to people. But effectively, that is 2620. This is 2630 in terms of kernel versions.
Trevor, are you trying to set up a MythTV cluster?
No.
Kernel arguments, as well as the kernel arguments that are regularly supported, it also accepts session underscore ID and node ID and auto encode ID. Basically what that means is session ID is the cluster. You could be running 20 clusters. You can have 256 clusters on the same network. They can talk to each other. Think of it sort of like VLANing. You can see not VLANing because you can't. In this case, you can see all the traffic, but you don't give a damn about it. That's effectively what it amounts to. Node ID is the individual node. It is set by default. If you have auto node ID on, it actually takes the last
last address of the standard IPv4 block that it has and puts it as its node name. Usually works because usually you're not running more than 256 nodes. If you run more than 256 nodes, you will have duplicates if you turn this on because it will have, say, 0, 1, and 1, 1. And it will be 1. They won't die.
So yeah, there's the presentation. Gonna go small thing. Just keeping that alive, that's all.
So, let's see. What is running on here? So kirk-adm, the command is here. I'll give you an example of kirk. You've got these commands. Kirk-adm is the administration. It gives you, administers the cluster and the nodes themselves. You can restart the cluster, which actually, incidentally, on each node, calls reboot. You don't want to do that. I do that, thinking it would just shut down the cluster part. You can also shut down individual nodes. You can kick them out of the cluster. You can add them back in. Again, not with this version, because I'm running 32-bit. Kirk capset is the thing that tells you what capabilities is what it stands for, Kirk capabilities set. So what it amounts to is you have to use this program to set that PID, can migrate remotely, that PID can access shared memory, all that stuff. If you don't set it, it won't happen. It just will run locally. Kirk legacy scheduler is actually MOSIX. Kirk came up with its own set of algorithms to load level. It included this so that you can use OpenMOSIX algorithms if you so choose. I don't know why. Kirk itself, you can actually really customize the schedulers. It's actually done with another file system, /config, which is config.fs. And by default, it's black magic, I don't touch it, but you can configure crazy load levelers to do round robin, to do weighted round robin, to do anything you want in terms of that. You can have machines running anywhere. Last one is kirk cr run. Basically what that amounts to is, well, checkpointing. You prefix it with that, you can then stop it and migrate it, kick it back out. Yeah.
How much of a performance hit do you take in checkpointing?
Haven't tested it to performance. I've tested to see if it worked. That's it. Performance, you probably take a hit, but I don't have much. But yeah.
So that's...
let's do this. H. So yeah, you've got options of cluster node. You can turn them all on or off, all that kind of stuff. Ban or unban them. So, oh my god, that node's acting up. Kick it off. Again, this will die horribly if I do that. Newer versions won't. You can see I have 5 machines running. 1-1, which is that boot node. You've got 25, 26, 27, and 29. Those are the IP addresses in the address space I'm using, because it's auto IP. But colon 1 is the cluster. That refers to the session ID.
Yep, yep.
So it can see all of them, but it won't actually care if it's 2 or 3 or anything else.
So that'll be LAN?
Yeah. In this particular instance, this is VLAN off because I'm running it off of a 24-port switch that houses the whole network for the house, including DHCP for other clients. So it is VLAN off. There's nothing else on here. But in actual cases, you could do it if you were to set the DHCP.com for specific hosts to PXU. I didn't want to bother.
I see the output of free.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm getting to.
Free-ish, huh? There you go. 65 gigs of memory. Keep in mind, this is running on 4 machines. Well, actually, 2 VMs, and so it's running on 5 machines. Yeah. So that memory is distributed across 5 machines.
I do
grab name you. How's that?
That's runtime. That is running right now.
And it is actually running some crazy stuff. Yeah. See. And you could have Intel in here. You could have VIA. You could have any x86 compatible CPU will work under this. So it allows you to do some really nifty stuff. You can see that there's many, many Gettys, there's many, many NTDs. And again, you have extended PID so that it can take that number of PIDs on the cluster. Each one actually runs SSHD, so that if you need to get into it, you can SSH to that IP and see what's running there. Again, local view would work.
Top? No, HTOP. Top doesn't show you the CPUs, for example.
It just goes down. Lots of swap, lots of memory. And there you go.
Happens.
Ah, yes, there you go. How's that? Mm-hmm. Decent amount of CPUs on there.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And keep in mind, this is with commodity hardware that I had in my basement. If you are a company or you're an institution that wants to do this, you could make it run on easily 80 nodes. I was going to run around two chassis, which would give 80 nodes, for example, and 80 gigs of RAM. I didn't have the time. But you could double that easily. And suddenly you're running a 160-core system with 160 or 320 gigs of RAM that you can address easily just by netbooting them. So let's go around the room, just shout out, what would you do with that kind of processing power?
It's currently your furnace.
Yes. how much power is this thing?
It's around 700 watts right now.
Yeah, there you go. That's because the AMDs are actually dual-socketed, and they're the old desktop machines from Prime. But if you were to run decent stuff, it wouldn't be that much.
I'm thinking, or you could turn on one of Sean Wallbridge's old SGI mainframes.
I asked where that was, but apparently it's up there, so we bought it. Anyways, that is effectively it. I'll show you with an H-top, just to round it out.
And again, you can see all of it there. You can migrate processes
across using...
Yeah, so you migrate just PID
and then node ID. Migrate a specific PID over to that node ID. I tried profusely to get stuff working with an example. Here's the crazy part. The head node in the guide that I followed has a CH root, NFS security guard. It does some black magic because it talks to the other nodes that actually have the file system that's in there. It's not running the same file system. The head node doesn't run the same file system. All the other nodes do. Yeah.
Can't, right.
Black magic. It's really quite crazy. So effectively what I was trying to do, which I failed miserably at, but I'll show you, is Linux, for example. You do a make-a12 HTML. Because I did not set the capabilities, you can see it's taking all the CPU on those two, but it's not migrating. I've got 12 things fighting for the CPU access for two of them. It's not migrating. That's where the curd cap comes in. Cap set, and it's crazy stuff, but basically dash K, say this shell, for example, and then plus H, and also just fork, and use remote. Where the hell is that? This will still fail, for some reason. I got to work in December. Now it's not. I don't know what's up. But I'm just telling you for a warning. If it works, I'll be really surprised. But again, you can see it's still on there. But in theory, it goes across. Keep that in mind.
Your make files can be embarrassingly parallel, too.
Yes, that is the main thing. With the Linux kernel, it works well. But by this point, no. By this point, you should. It ran through because I already had it built. But it ran through and should have done something to parallel. More to the point, it should be a testament as to how finicky these systems are. They provide you an SMP system that is great, that does great things, but you have to know how to use them. That's true for grids or distributed operating systems. Distributed operating systems are just kind of neat because they do stuff like that, where you have 10 processors that are actually running on 5 machines, and it works. It's black magic. So, yeah, that's about it. Any questions?
Yeah, I dare you to migrate PID 1.
I will at the end of it. How's that?
Okay.
What kind of scalability would you be looking at in terms of like running Apache on a cluster event?
It'll work fine. Keep in mind you're always I/O bound with this scenario. So assuming you have decent connectivity between the nodes, you could run MySQL Apache, you could run high-end stuff, you could run a memcached server, assuming it forks properly. Again, that's your memory, then becomes distributed, which becomes hell. But anything that forks correctly will work. Anything that uses a lot of CPUs that you just are using it really heavily, such as LTSP, is a great example. With this system, I could install LTSP, and it would work right away, because LTSP will be a process, which doesn't necessarily have to be on that processor. So it works. Keep in mind, you're always I/O bound. Always, always, always. Anything else? All right. So I'll see if I can migrate one. One. 29. Go. Oh. Right. Because
I don't have the curd cap set action set. Curd cap set dash K 1 plus 10. Migrate.
You can't stack that on the thing.
No, can't do it still. But
just as well.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff.
A lot of it, really, you really, really should not migrate things that use devices, things that, you know. Yeah. But there you go. It works.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meeting summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.